Okay, welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. My name is Daniel Swenson, or Dan Swenson, and I was not originally supposed to be the convener today. Originally, I was supposed to be Michael Nelson, but as I understand it, his father has broken a hip, I think, and so he's with him, and so you're going to get me instead. I was originally going to give like a 5-minute talk, so I've kind of expanded my talk a bit, but not a lot, so hopefully we'll be done. This is a time when we gather together. We don't have a creed that we follow in this fellowship. What we stand for and what we have been able to agree on is on the back page of your bulletin, if you want to look at it. And this is a time to welcome each other. If you listen to the music is tied to the story, the children's story today. And so that's going to be done by Barbara Bascom. If there is anybody who would like to stand up and introduce themselves, they're certainly welcome to at this time. But I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable. So don't if you don't want to. Okay, let's proceed on then. Announcements. So there's announcements in your bulletin, and please read those. I have two important announcements about what's coming up this week and today. After the service today, we're going to have coffee, not in our usual place, but in the old meeting room. And around that are going to be tables, and there's going to be committee members at the tables, and they're trying to recruit you. So if there's something that you're at all interested in, go to that table and you can help out this next year. So the second thing is next Saturday is a work day. It starts at 8:30 in the morning, and people are needed to work inside the building, outside the building, or to help bring food at lunch. So there's three different things you can do, and this is, if you want any information, talk to Elka Lorenz or Tom Manny, and this is a chance to try out the wiki. If you've never done a wiki before, you can go to uufm.net/wiki, or just go to uufm.net, and on the links page, there's a link to our wiki. And wiki is where you make a lot of lists, and just it's kind of a way to organize stuff. It's not a way for communication, but it's a way to list things. And you can go there, and Elka says it's real easy to do. Just add your name onto the wiki as a volunteer. So you can go there, look at it, and just have fun. Everybody can edit the wiki, so you can go there and do whatever you want to it. And it's a way that we're using to organize this workday. And I guess in a finally related way, it turns out thanks to Tom Manny, Chris Nakamura, and Mark Moser, they record the services, and now you can listen to those. Tom has been posting them on his own website. We now have it up on our own website, so you can go listen to a podcast of the service if somebody is sick or if you just want to listen to something again. Just go to the Sunday services part of our website. Are there any other announcements? I think Eric is breaking the rule here.
I was going to give this to, is this mic on? I was going to give this to Michael Nelson, and I expected him to be here, so when I didn't see him, I didn't give it to Dan. As chair of the board, I get lots of these official mailings from the district, and actually I do need to bring to your attention. If you are planning on attending, General Assembly, the Prairie Star District meeting in Omaha in 2 weeks, you are eligible to be a delegate from this congregation. We have the authority to assign 3 congregational delegates, and we have to do that before Wednesday, April 9th on the Prairie Star District website. So if you're planning on attending the district conference and would like to be a delegate, that is a representative of this congregation in a business action at the meeting, please contact me, let me know so we can get you signed up so that you'll get your credentials.
Well, I've asked one of the older children in the room to come up and help light the chalice. And he got a nudge by his wife, I see.
That's right.
Thanks, Charlie. Okay, let's have our first hymn today, and I do have a couple of requests about this hymn. I actually haven't practiced it with Marilyn. We're going to listen to it. I think it's a little bit different for us, so we're probably not used to singing it, so let's listen to her play it. The second request I have is, let's keep the tempo up, okay? We really tend to drag sometimes, and let's keep it moving. So, here we go. We're going to listen to it first. Thanks. This is a time where we can share with the community things in our lives, either joys or concerns. If somebody could explain better what's happening to Michael, I would appreciate that.
I got a call from Michael Nelson, I think it was Friday evening, that his father is in very bad health, and that is why he is not with us today. Is that enough for an explanation? Okay.
His father, who's very elderly, fell and broke his hip and something else, arm or something, and he's going to be having surgery, maybe today if they could work it out, and tomorrow. And it's not real good to go through surgery.
Well, I'm Jim Chanteau. I'm very glad to be back after, it's been a month since I've been here, spending the time with Doreen over at St. Francis Hospital in Topeka. She came home last weekend and has now been home a week, undergone dialysis three times since she's been here in Manhattan, and we continue to do so every other day. A couple of announcements about people contacting her. She's still recovering. We expect it's going to take at least 2, maybe 3 months before she gets back to normal. So for the time being, we're requesting that visitors really not stop by unless you've called in advance and Doreen says it's all right. Food also is a bit of a problem because she's on a very restricted diet because of the dialysis. And so most things don't work. So we really don't need much help there. However, there is a need to have people that could take her back and forth to doctors and dialysis and things like that. And we're asking that to be coordinated through Barbara Hacker. So if you're willing to do so, contact Barbara, and Barbara will be in touch with Doreen. And finally, wish to thank everybody for all the marvelous cards and wishes we received over the last 5 weeks of all this. It's been quite an ordeal. It's not over yet, but at least she's home. and surrounded by the things she loves, including her cats. And also our daughter is in town now, Jill, so that's a big help. But thanks again for all your love and wishes.
I have a joy that my dad is coming home in April.
We've had a busy couple of weeks. I'm Chris, that was Gabriel. Yes, his dad is coming home in April, and we're very, very happy to be in the final countdown, last like 3 or 4 weeks. My mom had to unexpectedly be moved to assisted living last week. That's why I wasn't here. She just suddenly started having panic attacks, and she's got Alzheimer's. It progressed a little more quickly than we thought it would. So that's why I was gone. My sister and I got that done. I bought a house. It's been a busy week. What can I say?
Hi, I'm Scott Tenona, and I have a concern that last week I forgot to thank the people who did such a great job setting up our meal and our brunch. So the Hobrooks, Kemp Thorns, Bascoms, Barbara Hacker, Terry France, and then especially those wonderful eggs, Angela Hayes, Ann Root, and their kids did those eggs, and they were great. So, I mean, that was very nice. I appreciate it.
Okay, I think we're going to have the children's story now. Now I think it's going to be a little bit different than that's given in the bulletin. We halfway through the story, the music that it was going to be used for the offertory is going to be part of the story. So I think we're going to have the offertory halfway through the story. So, thanks.
Story today is Brundabar, and Brundabar is an opera for children, and so this story is usually sung, but we're not going to sing it because we don't sing terribly well, and we're going to tell the story that from the words to the songs in the opera, and we're going to play a little of the music for you so you can hear that too. Brundabar was written in Czechoslovakia, and it's been translated to English, so I won't try to do Czechoslovakia, about two little children. And can you see that picture? Because my husband's going to show you the picture, and I have another copy of the book, so you can watch the pictures there. I am Pepacek, and I am Aninku, his little sister. Good morning, how are you? Good morning. We live in a house in the Yellow Hills with our mommy, who woke up one morning, oh, so sick. Quick, she said, fetch the doctor. And we did, and he came. And he put his cold red ear on mommy's chest, and she looked up at the ceiling, and the doctor said, run to town. You must bring mommy some milk. Fresh milk is the thing for children who are, for someone who's sick. So we grabbed a bucket, and we ran to town. We got there, and they said, you want milk? Then go to the square. And we did. And everyone was there. They were busy buying. Under an ice blue umbrella, an ice cream seller sold ice cream cones, singing out, creamy, drippy, chilly, yummy. Put my ice cream in your tummy. Nearby, a baker, his face like a sticky bun and eyes like raisins, and a red knob of a nose, shook his jelly jowls and sang, from my bakery, hot and... The pages aren't numbered. No, next one.
That's the ice cream seller. Okay.
There's the baker with all of his things. From my bakery, hot and stuffy, crackers crunchy, cream puffs puffy, cornbread, pumpernickel rye, every cookie, every pie. Turn the page. Finally we saw him, hooray, the milkman. Milk-o, milk-o, farm fresh milk-o, milk for kitties, milk for mutters, milk for cats, fresh cheese and butter. Turn the page. This looks like a, yes. Please, we need milk for mommy who is sick. And the milkman said, first you give me money, then I'll give you milk. No money, no milk, now skedaddle. So the, where do kids get money? Turn the page. Where do kids get money? Does anybody know? From grown-ups. And so Peppa Chicken and Ninku looked around. All around them, grown-ups walked, their money scrunched and tinkled. And in the picture, it's really funny because the dog has money and the lady has money falling out of her purse and the man has money he's trying to stuff in his pockets and hide, and everybody's got money. But they didn't have anything to sell to get any money. All they had was an empty bucket. But they looked across the square and they said, look there. Where? Across the square, that strange creature there. Turn the picture. And there, turn the page. Who is that? That is Brundabar. Brundabar. Brundabar had a hurdy-gurdy, and that's a little organ with a handle that you turn, and you play it, and you can get money, and you usually, the money's collected by a little monkey with a cup. His hurdy-gurdy pumped and wheezed, and the song he sang was awful, awful. You wanted to stay away from him. But the grown-ups were saying, bravo, Brundabar, because Brundabar was his name. Turn the page. Why don't we sing, said Aninku, and yes, good. Why don't we sing? Then people will pay us. So they sang a song that their mommy had taught them about a golden goose that flies through the sky. Turn the page. But although they sang as loud as they could, as two kids can sing, nobody paid any attention because Brundabar was still singing and making a lot of noise, and he had that obnoxious little monkey. Turn the page. We hopped up and down. We were that mad. Not fair. Hey, we look like dancing bears. And so they made themselves look like dancing bears to go give that organ grinder a scare. So we two bears loped across the square and raised our paws high in the air and shook our biggie, big, heavy bear bottoms. And grrr. Uh-oh, bears on the loose. They called the cops, who said, no bears on the square, it's against the law. And the milkman said, they're after my milk, because bears love milk. And Brundabar said, they're worse than bears, they're children. And Brundabar cranked his hurdy-gurdy, a mighty crank, and oh, what a horrible song he horribly sang. Little children, how I hate them, how I wish the bed bugs ate them. When they're rude and answer back, I'll stuff them in a burlap sack. Nasty little children, quiet, don't be loud, don't even try it. You'll find out what troubles are if you bother Brundabar. He sounded so loud that his eyes turned pink and his face turned purple and we were frightened. And what would you do? We ran away. And we hid in an alley full of old boxes and cast-off shoes. And maybe we cried a little because our bucket was empty and we had no money. And turn the page. Suddenly, a talking sparrow flew into the alley and said, they said, talking bird is absurd, but he says, it's not absurd. You shouldn't be scared. and you shouldn't be sitting here by yourself in the alley. And in came a talking cat. Right you are, hissed the silky voice. You must help these two beat Brundabar, but how? And the talking dog, who was very wise, came in. Brundabar is big, he said, and you are small. What do you do? What do you do when you're just a few? You ask for help. Get more of you. And the talking bird and the talking cat and the talking dog went off to town, and they went to the school and they went to the park and they went to the houses, and they came back to the alley with 300 children. And they all had signs that they were skipping school and they were going to help get milk for mommy, and they would do this by singing a song. Tramp, 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 they walked to the square. You need to turn the page. You turn the page. And Brundabar tried to tell them they couldn't sing there, but the people saw 302 children and a cat and a dog and a bird, and they wanted to hear what they could sing. So now what we're going to do is we're going to listen to the real opera and hear the children's song. And some one of you can help take the baskets out, and people can give money for milk. So mommy won't be sick anymore. It's track 15, I think. And we'll keep the music, let it keep going, because you'll hear the story from the opera.
Wow, it's unbelievable. Anaku, the pail is full.
Mr. Milkman,
he says, wow, unbelievable, because the bucket is full of gold coins, and everyone threw them.
Not before my fee's
and
been
that's Brundabar.
I work
Brundabar
here. What's in that pail?
Take their money away.
Stop chewing on my tail. Belongs to me. It can't
he says
be
it belongs to me.
This is my street. Pay me.
But everybody says no, and the 300 children and all the people that listened,
and the cat went after his hat, and the dog bit at his heels, and the sparrow flew into the over everybody, and he dropped his bucket, and the money went everywhere, and the children won. And they're saying that Brundibar was trounced and bumped and squished and vanquished. And just ask anybody who was there and they'll tell you. So the dog and the cat and the sparrow and the stool kids cheered. They said, exit, Brundibar, disappear. And milkman, have you had any milk to sell? And he says, that mommy isn't feeling very well. And so they got their milk and they took it home to mommy. And the doctor went home, and the children had a big celebration. And some of them played trumpets and French horns and violins. And all the rest of the 300 children, they sang their song. And they sang, our friends will make us strong, and this is the way we'll end our song. And so that's the end of the story of Brundibar. And thank you very much. The opera Brundibar was written by a Jewish Czech composer, Hans Krása, in 1938. In 1942, he was deported to Terezín, a ghetto created by Nazis to amass European Jews in one location prior to transportation to the East for the final solution. In Terezín, Krása's opera Brundibar was performed more than 50 times by children and musicians from the ghetto, because it was a special ghetto where people who had creative arts talent were amassed, and they were shown off to inspectors, including Red Cross inspection of 1944, which has become quite famous, to demonstrate that concentration camps were positive places. At any rate, every year there is a remembrance performance of Brundibar. There were some survivors, but most of the children and all of the musicians, including the composer of this children's opera, which lasts only 35 minutes, but is a beautiful little performance, and I have recordings for any of you who might be interested in it, but he was killed at Auschwitz in 1944. Also at Terezín concentration camp, there weren't just musicians. There were poets, there were writers. There was a little newsletter that was written by a boy, and I have a copy of that. And the drawings and poems have become quite famous and are now published under the title of I Never Saw a Butterfly. When the war ended, there was one of the, a man who had sponsored some of the children in his home when they came out of Terezín. He was head of one of the girls' homes. He collected everything that had been written by the children and was left there after they'd gone. All of their writings, if the poem's authors had not survived, which was rare, and hadn't taken the poems back, were collected and given to the Jewish Museum in Prague, and that's how they came to be saved. But it was years later before the value of them was really determined. And the most famous poem is I Never Saw Another Butterfly, and I'm going to read that to you today. The butterfly, the last, the very last, so richly, brightly, dazzling yellow, perhaps if the sun's tears would sing against a white stone, such a yellow, is carried lightly, way up high. It went away, I'm sure, because it wished to kiss the world goodbye. For 7 weeks I've lived in here, pinned up inside this ghetto, but I have found what I love here, the dandelions call to me, and the white chestnut branches in the court. Only I never saw another butterfly. That butterfly was the last one. Butterflies don't live here in the ghetto. And that's Peter Friedman, Pavel Friedman, in 1942, when he wrote that poem.
Well, I guess what I'd ask now is we just have a time of silence for meditation before the next reading. Well, one of the real pleasures of being convener is you get to pick whatever you want to read. And so you're going to hear Dickens today. And this is dedicated to everybody who's working in the public schools and working on No Child Left Behind. Now, what I want is facts. Teach these boys and girls nothing but facts. Facts alone are warranted in life. Plant nothing else and root out everything else. You can only form the minds of reasoning animals upon facts. Nothing else will ever be of service to them. This is the principle on which I bring up my own children, and this is the principle on which I bring up these children. Stick to facts, sir. In this life, we want nothing but facts, sir. Nothing but facts. The speaker and the schoolmaster and the third grown person present all backed a little and swept with their eyes the inclined plane of little vessels then and there arranged in order, ready to have imperial gallons of facts poured into them until they were full to the brim. Thomas Gradgrind, sir, a man of realities, a man of facts and calculations, a man who proceeds upon the principle that two and two are four and nothing over, and who is not to be talked into allowing for anything over. Thomas Gradgrind, sir, peremptorily Thomas Gradgrind, with a rule and a pair of scales and the multiplication table always in his pocket, sir, ready to weigh and measure any parcel of human nature and tell you exactly what it comes to. It is a mere question of figures, a case of simple arithmetic. You might hope to get some other nonsensical belief into the head of George Gradgrind or Augustus Gradgrind or John Gradgrind or Joseph Gradgrind, all supposititious, non-existent persons. But into the head of Thomas Gradgrind? No, sir. Girl number 20, said Mr. Gradgrind, squarely pointing with his square forefinger. I don't know that girl. Who is that girl? Sissy Jupe, sir, explained number 20, blushing, standing up and curtsying. Give me your definition of a horse. Sissy Jupe, thrown into the greatest alarm by this demand. Girl number 20, unable to define a horse, said Mr. Gradgrind, for the general behoof of all the little pitchers. Girl number 20, possessed of no facts, in reference to one of the commonest of animals. Some boy's definition of a horse. Blitzer, yours. The square finger moved here and there, lighted suddenly on Bitzer. Bitzer, said Thomas Gradgrind, your definition of a horse. Quadruped, gramnivorous, 40 teeth, namely 24 grinders, 4 eye teeth, and 12 incisive. Sheds coat in the spring. In marshy countries, shed hooves too. Hooves hard, but requiring to be shod with iron. Age known by marks in mouth. Thus, and much more, Bitzer. Now, girl number 20, said Mr. Gradgrind, you know what a horse is. And then the chapter goes on with discussions of flowers and pictures of horses. And once again, Sissy is asked. Girl number 20, said the gentleman, smiling in the calm strength of knowledge. Sissy blushed and stood up. So, you would carpet your room or your husband's room if you were a grown woman and had a husband with representations of flowers, would you? Said the gentleman. Would you? If you please, sir, I am very fond of flowers, returned the girl. And is that why you would put tables and chairs upon them and have people walking over them with heavy boots? It wouldn't hurt them, sir. They wouldn't crush and wither, if you please, sir. They would be the pictures of what was very pretty and pleasant, and I would fancy. Aye, 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 but you mustn't fancy, cried the gentleman, quite elated by coming so happily to his point. That's it. You are never to fancy. Fact, 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 said the gentleman, and fact, 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 repeated Mr. Gradgrind. Now, if Mr. Ochokumchild, said the gentleman, will proceed to give his first lesson here, Mr. Gradgrind, I shall be happy at your request to observe his mode of procedure. Mr. Gradgrind was much obliged. Mr. Ochokumchild, we only wait for you. So, Mr. Ochokumchild began in his best manner. He and some 140 other schoolmasters had been lately turned at the same time, in the same factory, on the same principles, like so many pianoforte legs. He had been put through an immense variety of paces and had answered volumes of head-breaking questions: orthography, etymology, syntax, prosody, biography, astronomy, geography, and general cosmography, the sciences of compound proportion, algebra, land surveying and leveling, vocal music and drawing from models were all at the ends of his 10 chilled fingers. He had worked his stony way into Her Majesty's Most Honorable Privy Council's Schedule B and had taken the bloom off the higher branches of mathematics and physical science, French, German, Latin, and Greek. He knew all about the watersheds of all the world, whatever they are, and all the histories of all the peoples and all the names of all the rivers and mountains and all the productions, manners, and customs of all the countries and all their boundaries and bearings on the 32 points of compass. Ah, rather overdone, Ochokumchild. If he had only learnt a little less, how much infinitely better he might have taught much more. He went to work in this preparatory lesson not unlike Morgiana in the 40 Thieves, looking into all the vessels ranged before him, one after another, to see what they contained. Say, good Ochokumchild, when from thy boiling store thou shalt fill each jar brim full by and by, dost thou think that thou wilt always kill outright the robber fancy lurking within, or sometimes only maim him and distort him? It was amazing to listen to that book again. I checked it out of the library. It's just a fun, you know, I'd never read it before, actually, so it was fun. So, well, now you're getting my talk for today, and I hope we'll have, I know we will have plenty of time to discuss it if it's of interest, or go and have coffee if we don't want to do any more. So, last weekend I was sitting at the table with my wife, Kathy, and I looked across at her and I said, well, next Sunday I'm going to talk about morality. And so she looked back and she kind of cocked her head and she said, you? Well, this talk, it was prompted by Michael Nelson. I don't know if you remember, a couple weeks ago, he kind of made fun of Bill Gates for being too busy to go to church, and he honored Mother Teresa as an example of a moral person. It turns out I had just been reading an essay by Steven Pinker, and much of my talk is directly quoted from this essay. So it's just to make sure I'm not plagiarizing, you know what I'm doing. So, but that precise example had been used at the beginning of the essay, and Steven Pinker had at least raised the option of other conclusions, opposite conclusions. And besides, so I went up to Michael afterwards and I told him that. And I said, well, you know, Bill Gates is in some ways at least one of my heroes. You know, I'm so tired of religious pomposity that we see around us. And here's a guy who's not afraid to say he doesn't go to church. And then he turns around and literally gives most of his money away. You know, and that just makes me feel so proud as somebody who is a secular humanist to see somebody do that. So I just feel like, you know, take that, James Dobson. You go do it. I'm so proud to see that. So, which would you say is the most admirable? Mother Teresa, Bill Gates, or Norman Borlaug? And which do you think is the least admirable? For most people, it's an easy question. Mother Teresa is famous for ministering to the poor in Calcutta. You know, she's been beautified by the Vatican. She's been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize and ranked in an American poll as one of the most admired persons of the 20th century. Bill Gates, you know, he gave us the Microsoft dancing paperclip, and he gave us the blue screen of death, and he's been decapitated in effigy on the web, and he's been hit with a pie in his face. And then finally, Norman Borlaug, you know, who is Norman Borlaug? Nobody knows. But a deeper look might make you rethink your surface response. Borlaug is the father of the Green Revolution, and that he has used agricultural service to reduce world hunger and has been credited with saving 1 billion lives. That's more than anyone else in history. Gates, in deciding what to do with his fortune, crunched the numbers and decided to give away more than $30 billion to his charity to alleviate the most misery by fighting everyday scourges in the developing world like malaria, diarrhea, and parasites. And those just hadn't been receiving funding because there wasn't money to be made addressing those issues. Mother Teresa, for her part, extolled the virtue of suffering and ran her well-financed missions accordingly. Their sick patrons were offered plenty of prayer, but were in harsh conditions, few analgesics, and dangerously primitive medical care. So it's not hard to see why the moral reputations of the trio should be so out of line with the actual good they have done. Mother Teresa was the very embodiment of goodness. You know, she wore white, she was sad-eyed, she was ascetic, often photographed with the wretched of the earth. Gates is a nerd, okay, and he was at some times the world's richest man. I think most recently it's Warren Buffett's claim to be the world's richest man. As likely for Gates to enter heaven as the proverbial camel squeezing through the needle's eye. And Borlaug is an agronomist who has spent his life in labs and nonprofits, seldom walking onto the media stage, and hence we don't even hardly know about him at all. Just as an aside, you know, Gates, you know, we all know about Warren Buffett. He's now decided to earmark the majority of his Berkshire charity shares to charity, and it's irrevocable, so it's going to happen. When he made the decision, it was $31 billion. It's worth a lot more right now. I don't know him, but he does have some interesting, he must be quite a character, more than we realize. He was married in 1952 to Susan Thompson. They had 3 children. From all accounts, he's absolutely devoted to his wife, was heartbroken when she decided to leave Omaha and pursue a singing career in 77. They separated, they remained married. Before she left Omaha, she made sure that she introduced him to another woman named Astrid Manx, with whom he lived when she left Omaha. And he eventually married her on his 76th birthday after his wife's death in 2004. And all 3 remained close. Every year they would get together, the whole family, for an annual gathering. Holiday cards to their friends were signed Warren, Susie, and Astrid. And finally, he made sure that his children will not inherit a significant proportion of his wealth. Now, they'll still be doing fine, I'm sure. But most of his money is going away. So, how do we judge morality? I admire most a person who, in a decisive act, looks at the world, commits to improving it, and thus I would argue that Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are at least as moral as Mother Teresa. Okay, so this has been an introduction, but it's really a diversion from what I think is the deeper question. And the deeper question is, what is the basis for morality? You know, we here claim to be moral people, yet we profess no creed, we recognize no other higher authority, we ascribe to seven principles, but on what foundation are those principles set? There is recent work in this area, now that we can both look at our brains as we process thought, and as we continue to improve our understanding of evolution and our continue to improve our understanding of the animal world. It turns out the human moral sense turns out to be an organ of considerable complexity with quirks that reflect its evolutionary history and its neurobiological foundations. So when we start to think about moralization or morality, we have to start appreciating that it is distinct from other parts of our psychology. We have to start looking at it, and we need to see how moral judgments differ from other kinds of opinions we have on people, how they ought to behave. Moralization is a psychological state that can be turned on and off like a switch, and when it is on, it makes us deem actions immoral, killing is wrong, rather than merely disagreeable. I hate Brussels sprouts. So what are some of the characterizations of moralization? The first hallmark of moralization is that the rules it invokes are felt to be universal. So we have prohibitions of rape and murder that are felt not to be matters of local custom, but to be universally and objectively warranted. So they apply to everybody, independent of their society. The other hallmark that you note is that we feel that those who commit immoral acts deserve to be punished. So as a result, people are untroubled in inviting either divine retribution or the power of the state to harm the people they deem immoral. A real insight, I think, that is that much of our recent social history, including the cultural wars between liberals and conservatives, consists of the moralization or amoralization of particular kinds of behavior. And we're going to come back again, the liberals and conservatives, as we'll see, focus on different parts of moralization. And an example is smoking, which has recently turned into a moral issue. The reason is that until recently, it was understood that some people didn't enjoy smoking or avoided it because it was hazardous to their health. But now that we understand the harmful effects of secondhand smoke, smoking is now treated as an immoral act. Smokers are ostracized, images of people smoking are censored, and entities touched by smoke are felt to be contaminated, and the desire for retribution has been at least partially visited on some of the tobacco companies. At the same time, many behaviors that have been amoralized, that is, they are no longer considered moral issues, and they have switched from moral failings to lifestyle choices. And those include things like divorce, illegitimacy, being a working mother, homosexuality. So many afflictions have been reassigned from a payback for bad choices to unlucky misfortunes, in addition to lifestyle choices. So now let's think about a little bit about when we make a moral issue. We like to think that we have a conviction and there are good reasons for us to adopt a certain moral stance. However, it's generally agreed that people don't engage in moral reasoning, but instead they engage in what's called moral rationalization. They begin with the conclusion, they try to cough up, the conclusion is known to them by an unconscious emotion, and then they try to work backwards to a plausible justification. And so now people are they're exploring different games you can play with to help them understand this and actually see this in action. So there was a large cross-cultural study and that looked at an experiment called the trolley problem, and maybe you've heard of this. So on your morning walk, you see a trolley car hurtling down the track. The conductor is slumped over the controls. In the path of the trolley are five men working on the track, oblivious to the danger. You are standing at a fork in the track. You can pull a lever that will divert the trolley onto a spur, saving the five men. Unfortunately, the trolley would then run over a single worker who is laboring on the spur. Is it permissible to throw the switch? killing one man to save five men. Almost everyone says yes. Across countries, across cultures, everybody agrees that that's fine. Now here's a slightly different scene. You are on a bridge overlooking the tracks and have spotted the same rail runaway trolley bearing down on the five workers. Now the only way to stop the trolley is to throw a heavy object in its path, and it just happens that there's a fat man standing next to you. Should you throw the man off the bridge? So both dilemmas present you with the option of sacrificing one life to save five, and by the utilitarian standard, and Dickens was fighting utilitarians, as you might have picked up from the previous reading, by the utilitarian standard of what would result in the greatest good for the greatest number, they're morally equivalent. But just about everybody does not see it that way. Though they would pull the switch in the first dilemma, they would not heave the fat man in the second. And when pressed for a reason, they really can't come up with anything coherent to explain what their difference. So one of the persons, Joshua Green, suggests that evolution equipped people with a revulsion to manhandling an innocent person. This instinct, he suggests, tends to overwhelm any utilitarian calculus that would tot up the lives saved and lost. So the impulse against roughing up a fellow human would explain other examples in which people abjure killing one to save many, like euthanizing a hospital patient to harvest his organs and save five dying patients in need of transplants, or throwing someone out of a crowded lifeboat to keep it afloat. Okay, so this is, so far it's just an argument. You know, you can make this argument, it's a story, you can do it. But what's neat is now they've actually gone and measured people's brains as they're being given these questions, and you look for brain areas that are associated with emotion, that is, those are the areas that would recoil from harming someone, and areas dedicated to rational analysis. Those are the ones that do the calculations. You know, should I take five for one? So when people pondered the dilemmas that required killing someone with their bare hands, several networks in their brains lighted up. One was the part implicated in emotions about people, and the second was the part associated with ongoing mental computation. And the third region lit up, which is the part that registers conflicts between two parts of the brain coming in and tries to resolve the conflicts between the two parts of the brain. However, when people were looking at the hands-off dilemma, or that's the one where they did not have to throw the person over, but they just had to do the switch, the brain reacted differently. Only the area involved in the calculations was activated. So this corroborates that our non-utilitarian intuitions, that is, the things that, if you just did the pure math, you would say, we should go this way, but we often come to moral conclusions that are non-utilitarian, come from the victory of emotional impulse over a cost-benefit analysis. So the idea that moral sense is an innate part of human nature is not far-fetched, because when anthropologists go out across the globe, they find themes keep popping up consistently. It's bad to harm others, good to help them. There's a sense of fairness. You reciprocate fair favors, you reward benefactors, you punish cheaters. People value loyalty to a group. They believe it's right to defer to legitimate authorities and respect people with high status, and they exalt purity, cleanliness, and sanctity as general. So I've identified five things there. So there's five. So some of the people suggest those are primary colors of our moral sense. Not only do they keep reappearing in cross-cultural surveys, but each one kind of makes sense with our own moral intuitions and our own culture. So this brings us to a way to look at moral sense that can be both universal and recognize its variability at the same time. And I should say, the paper I'm quoting from goes and talks about these five different senses and identifies them with at least being consistent with evolutionary knowledge. So the five moral senses, we can argue, are universal, a legacy of evolution, but how they get ranked in importance and which is brought in to moralize which area of social life depends on your culture. Many of the flabbergasting practices in faraway places become more intelligible when you recognize that the same moralizing impulse that Western elites, that is us, channel to violations of harm and fairness, those are what we tend to worry about, is channeled elsewhere to violations in other spheres. Think of the Japanese who fear of nonconformity. That's their focus on community. The holy ablutions and dietary restrictions of Hindus and Orthodox Jews, that's tied to purity. The outrage at insulting the prophet among Muslims, that's tied to authority. So in the West, we believe that in business and government, fairness should trump community, and we try to root out nepotism and cronyism. In other parts of the world, this is incomprehensible. You know, what heartless creep would favor a perfect stranger over his own brother? So you can see that you can focus on different aspects that we all have evolved. So the ranking and placement of moral spheres also divides the cultures of liberals and conservatives in the United States. Many bones of contention, like homosexuality, atheism, and one-parent families from the right, or racial imbalances, sweatshops, and executive pay from the left, reflect different weightings of the five spheres. Liberals put moral weight on harm and fairness, and we play down group loyalty, authority, and purity. Conservatives place a moderately high weight on all five of those categories. So it's not surprising that each side thinks it is driven by lofty ethical values and the other side is base and unprincipled. So it comes from this moral sense of what you focus on. So now here's the worry. If the distinction between right and wrong is just a product of brain wiring, why should we believe it to be any more real than the distinction between red and green? You know, we've just evolved to see different things. If it's just a collective hallucination, how could we argue that evils like genocide and slavery are wrong for everyone rather than just tasteful to us? So, of course, the traditional way has been to put God in charge of morality. But, and here I wish I was a better, I knew more of my philosophy. But anyway, Plato solved that 2,400 years ago. So even before Christ, he'd already figured out the problem. So does God, and his question was this: does God have a good reason for designating certain acts as moral and other as immoral? Okay, so does God have a reason for deciding what is moral? If he does not, or she does not, if her dictates are divine whims, why should we take them seriously? They're just whims of setting up rules. So suppose that God commanded us to torture a child. Would that make it all right? Or would some other standard give us reasons to resist? And if, on the other hand, God was forced by moral reasons to issue some dictates and not others, if a command to torture a child was never an option, then we don't need God. Let's just appeal to those reasons directly. So we have this belief, certainly I think here in the Unitarian Fellowship, that there are things that are independent of the being dictated from above. And so what can bring those, how can those be justified, and how can we argue about them? So two features, at least of the world, and of course we've got a lot more, this needs to be continued, is two features of reality point at a rational self-preserving social agent in the direction of morality. And one of these is the prevalence of non-zero-sum games. And what that means is, if something benefits me, a zero-sum game is if I get a benefit, I have to take it away from you. So my gain is your loss. But in real life, there's a lot of things that if I gain, it turns out you gain also. And that can drive us in a moral sense. So for instance, two parties are objectively better off if they both act in a non-selfish way than if each of them acts selfish. You and I are both better off if we share our surpluses, rescue each other's children in danger, and refrain from shooting at each other, compared with hoarding our surpluses while they rot, letting the other child drown while we file our nails, or feuding like Hatfields and McCoys. Now, granted, I might be better off if I acted selfishly at your expense and you played the sucker, but the same is true for you with me, so if each of us tried those advantages, we'd both end up worse off. Any neutral observer, and you and I, if we could talk it over rationally, would have to conclude that the state we should aim for is the one in which we are both unselfish. So these spreadsheet calculations are not quirks of brain wiring. So the argument is not only do we have evolutionary developed moral instincts, but you can rationally argue that in ways that lead to unselfish behavior, they're in the nature of things. The other external support for morality is the feature of rationality itself. That is, anything rational cannot depend on the focus of the reasoner, on the egocentric focus of the reasoner. If I appeal to you to do anything that affects me, to get off my foot, to tell me the time, or not run me over with your car, then I can't do it in a way that privileges my interests over yours. I can't say logically, that applies to me, but not to you. If I want you to take it seriously, I have to state my case in a way that would force me to treat you in the same way. I can't act as if my interests are special just because I'm me and not you. The core of this idea keeps reappearing, of course, and of course we call it the Golden Rule, and there's many other philosophies that embody that. So there are logical reasons that lead us to act morally in addition to just what we have gotten from evolution. So morality is something still larger than our inherited moral sense. And the new science of the moral sense does not make moral reasoning and conviction obsolete. At the same time, it does have profound implications for our world. At the very least, the science tells us that even when our adversary's agenda is most baffling, they may not be amoral psychopaths, but in the throes of a moral mindset that appears to them to be every bit as mandatory and as universal as ours does to us. In any conflict in which a meeting of the minds is not completely hopeless, a recognition that the other guy is acting from moral rather than venal reasons can be a first patch of common ground. So we need to recognize that other people focus on different things than us. The science of the moral sense also alerts us to the ways in which our psychological makeup can get in the way of our arriving at the most defensible moral conclusions. The moral sense is as vulnerable to illusions as our other senses. It's apt to confuse morality with purity, status, and conformity. That's what we talked about at the beginning when we talked about Mother Teresa. It tends to reframe practical problems as moral crusades. So instead of trying to solve something in a rational way, we tend to get on our moral horse and thus see the solution to those in punitive aggression. So thinking you're morally correct makes you feel that you can punish the person who's not morally correct, and so it tends to encourage aggression. It imposes taboos that make us certain ideas are indiscussable, and it has the nasty habit of always putting the self on the side of angels. We always think we're right, the other people are wrong. So the science of the moral sense can advance morality by allowing us to see through the illusions that evolution and culture have saddled us with, and to focus on goals that we can share and defend. Anton Chekhov, who I need to read more of, I haven't read him, man will become better when you show him what he is like. So, I think we have time for some discussion here, and we've got some people in the audience who are much more qualified than I am to comment on this.
Thank you.
Thanks, Elka. Somebody would like to come up here and ask a question, that'd be fine. It's going to take a little bit. To visitors, the reason we're so focused on the microphone is there are people who, we are recording this, so, and also there's people with earphones, so there we go.
I'm also not crazy about the word morality, but I understand its use, and I think part of the reason that I'm not crazy about it is it's been so co-opted by the right, the moral majority. I grew up in the 80s hearing that. What I wanted to say was I really appreciated everything you said in general, because one of the things that just drives me to, like, practically mute fury today in our culture here in America is the assumption that there is no morality without religion, that you can't have a moral compass if you don't have a higher authority. And it just infuriates me. And it's nice now that I have some good arguments to talk about that, and I appreciate that.
In that study about throwing somebody off the bridge, did anybody volunteer to jump themselves? Because that would be my instinct, which gets me into a lot of trouble.
I'm afraid my quotes are third hand, so I do not know the study and I don't know
Eat the fast,
details.
Then jump.
I would imagine there were people who would do that.
Yes.
Kathy Hedge, maybe our sociologists in here can help us, but I remember reading something about 10 years ago, and actually might have even been like 15 years ago, and it was very interesting because it talked about that across all cultures, one thing that was found is that there was sort of a really common number of people with particular types of moral compasses, that there were like 15% that were in cultures across, you know, people who had never seen a television versus people who are right in the middle of the industrial society, and about 15% that were completely amoral. It didn't matter what was going to happen, that it was me, whatever's going to work for me. And then there was another like 50 or 60% above that who, no, it wasn't that big. Another maybe 40% above that who would do things because they were afraid of being punished. And then there was another level above that who would do things, you know, most of the time because they felt it was the right thing to do. And then there was another 15% on the top of that. I know my numbers are all off, that's okay. But anyway, the very, very top percent were our individuals who, no matter what the consequence would be for that individual, if they truly believed it was the right thing to do, they would sacrifice everything. And that's where we get our Gandhis and, you know, our people who just give everything because their moral, their ethical compass is so strong that they cannot allow themselves to do the wrong thing. It's a matter of survival for their own psyche. So I've just wondered if anybody else had heard anything like that or knew more about it, if that's been proved valid or if that was a fad back in the 90s.
I do remember discussions of that. Now, I would like to say in the article I had, there's clearly, they talked about people with certain kinds of brain damage who no longer have the part of the brain that brings who turn into pure utilitarians. They lose the emotional part that brings, you know, out the non-utilitarian. And I do remember that discussion. I mean, there's all kinds of various ways to look at it. Well, he's walking over there. You know, one argument about you have to have the Bible. Well, I actually went back and read the Ten Commandments. Turns out it's just a part of about 50 pages of the Bible that are all these rules about what you should do. You know, it's just, turns out about what you should do about your slave. You know, when you let your slave go and you married her, do you get to keep the wife and the kids that they had when they were your slaves? And it just goes on and on and on about, you know, all this stuff.
I was wondering, you mentioned evolutionary feelings and thoughts about, should I use the word morality or ethics? I've heard the expression, we're taught whom to hate. In other words, before Plato, who taught ethics or right behavior? And don't all of us have to be taught what is best or what is good?
I think there's the article certainly argues that there are deep evolutionary behaviors. For instance, rhesus monkeys, if they are offered food and at the same time they take food, they have to shock another monkey, will not take the food. And I know there is now other primate studies that certainly they have very much the idea of fairness. They know which other primates will share with them. And they remember, you know, if I gave that, I'll say monkey, a banana and he doesn't give it back to me. It looks like we have a real expert down here, so I'm going to shut up. Okay. We got one more minute, so that's it.
I'd like to say in connection with what Florence is saying, if somebody is in a closed system and is told this is good for or bad for somebody, they'll do it. But when they get to see the actual result for themselves, it takes a strong control. It takes a strong, I'm sorry, I'm going to say religion or socialization to break the moral compass, to make people continue to do something they can see is harming someone else. That's kind of a short circuit.
Okay, I'm going to pull the rules here, and we can talk about it more afterwards. With that, I think we'll just join at the coffee tables, and please make sure everybody signs up for at least two committees, huh?